At Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr, we're all about celebrating the journey of life and leadership, no matter what stage you're at. And that's where our partners at Standard Life come in. For decades, Standard Life have been helping people navigate life's most important transitions, from planning your financial future to embracing the opportunities that come with a new chapter in life. Whether you're starting your career or nearing retirement, Standard Life is there. Working with financial advisors, they help you plan for your life journey and do it with confidence. Because getting you ready for your best second life involves financial planning, but it's also about making sure you're ready to live it well. So wherever you are at in your life or career, let Standard Life help you plan for tomorrow while enjoying today. Visit standardlife.ie to find out more about planning for your best second life. Standard Life International DAC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Now you're very welcome to Life and Leadership. I'm out and about. I'm about to enter a car for this interview. And my guest today is Mark Fennell. Let's get down to business.
Let's buckle up.
Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr. A News Talk original.
Brought to you by Standard Life, a life savings company for your journey to and through retirement.
Now, Mark Fennell is a high-performance life coach, he's an author, and he's a motivational speaker. During his 20 years of mentoring, he's worked with many top global corporations, individuals and teams in changing mindsets and behaviours. He regularly appears on BBC, Virgin, Ireland AM, News Talk, and many other radio and TV networks. He's a massive online following, he's got 337,000 Instagram followers. Mark, how are you?
I'm very well, Bobby, and thanks for having me on the show.
Good. Well, listen, I've been reading all about you and I've been looking forward to meet you. Bring us back to where it all began. Cabin Teely, I know, later Dunleary, but tell us about your early years.
Yeah, early years. As I say, grew up in Dunleary and Cabin Teely. In fact, we ended up moving because we were in a rough area. And my parents were saying, you know, they wanted to give us a good opportunity and not see us negatively influenced. So young age, we were moved from there and we moved to Cabin Teely. And my parents were very hard workers and they instilled that in us. And from there, it really, I suppose, planted the seeds because, you know, obviously becoming what I did, a coach in that, they did a lot of youth work and a lot of charity work. And now, we were only young at the time, but we were dragged along to help pour the orange or give out the crisps or whatever. But it did plant a seed in us to see that it's a very rewarding work, so to speak. You know, we didn't want to always be there at that age, but that's where the seed was planted, I suppose, in helping other people.
Did you have siblings, brothers,
yeah,
sisters?
Yeah, two sisters. I'm the eldest. And we obviously schooling and so forth was took off and took over. And then later on, I decided to become an electrician. So that was the plan, headed off to DIT and studied there and qualified. But mid that, I was volunteering as a youth worker in the inner city. And I was just volunteering just the weekends, but I just found it very rewarding. Little did I realise that things were going to change quite dramatically for me.
I want to talk, obviously, about your electrical contracting career. You say you moved from wiring people's houses to wiring people's minds you do now.
But it's been said to me
before we get to college, did you find schooling difficult?
I was always born to work for myself. I always had that bug. Like when I was 7 years old, I'll give an example, right? There was a tree chopped down beside us and they were chopping it up for it to be sent off. And I said, you know what, if I get those sticks and sell them door to door. Now I'm 7, 8 years old at this stage. And I said, if I sell them, because I used to see them at the garage being sold. So I got a bike, got some bags from Super Value, put the logs in the bag and started selling them door to door. So the entrepreneurial thing was always there. So school for me was a necessity. It was just got to get it done so I can really get to work after that. I did okay in school, actually. I wasn't always great in some topics, but I think it's like everything. You know, if you're in school and you get one or two good teachers that believe in you, I think that will really goes the distance.
Yeah.
And I had that.
And were you talk about entrepreneurial stuff that you did. Were you a confident child?
No, I was, interesting you asked that, because for a good few years of my school, I was bullied quite badly.
Okay.
No, it was chronic. So, like, you know, cigarettes being flicked at you, bet up, made stand in dog's dirt. It was really bad. And that went on for almost 3 years. So that any confidence I had was pretty much gone.
Oh, dear.
By the end of that. And then I moved schools and into another school. And then the first day of that school, I realized, thinking it was a new school, clean slate, clean start. And the guy who'd been bullying me had joined the same school. He was standing there in the schoolyard the first day I got there. Couldn't believe it.
And were you scarred by that? Do you like, it's funny you mention it now, but is it something that you brought with you all over the years, or did you forget about it and get on with your life?
You know what? I ended out, I suppose, in many ways, I made a decision. You know, I can be quiet, the humble mouse in the corner, and this will continue, or I can stand up. And I ended up standing up to him. And inside I was like, I'm going to be beat up here. This is going to be the worst thing ever I could do. But I just had enough. And I think what the lesson it taught me is a lesson that I didn't realize at the time, but I realize now. When the pain of staying the same becomes far more than the pain of what it costs to grow,
yeah,
you end up getting tipping the scales and saying, you know what, to stay the same is more painful than the effort I'm going to have to put in to make the change. And that's what it is. I stood up to him, and eventually it stopped. And it just then gave me that self-belief. You know, if you stand up for yourself, you know, who knows what you can do. So the confidence started to build back up, teenage years.
And we'll move off this now. But can I ask you, if you met him or others that were with him bullying you today? Mm.
I did.
And how did you deal with that?
Yeah, a couple of years ago, I'm walking into a restaurant and he was walking out, and he's a very large, big guy. And he looked at me, I looked at him, immediately recognised each other. It's interesting because, you know, it's not something that gave me hassle going into adult life or anything. It was kind of back then. But for that split second, you're teleported back to being that victim, that child again. It's fascinating, you know?
Yeah.
And we had that kind of exchange of glances, and you get a mix of emotions. But then I kind of, I suppose, being where I'm at now, I realized, I said hello to him. I said, how are you? You know, and I'm whatever. And he was a bit sheepish, and he kind of left then. And I felt like amazing the way I was able to, that chapter's closed and never to reopen.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a well, and I'm glad it happened, because if it didn't happen, I don't know if my confidence would be where it is today.
Yeah.
Because it was the hard way to grow confidence, but nonetheless it did grow.
It's like any learning. If you learn it the hard way,
you never forget it.
It tends to stay with you.
And that is the truth.
Move us on then. You mentioned DIT. You mentioned electrical engineering. What brought you to that? Well, where was your interest there?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah, you know what? And that question, it's a really good question, because I've seen this same pattern with me. I always like to know how things work. Not just what they do or how they do it, but why they do it.
Okay.
You know? And I was always like that with electrical or anything like that, mechanical. And I was always good at that. And that same ethos has stuck with me. And now when I work with people in their thinking patterns or their psychology, I tend to think that way, the why, the how, and the what. And that has always stuck with me. So as you alluded to earlier on, people have said you used to rewire houses, now you rewire mindsets. Because I got out of the electrical very young. I was 21, 22 when I was fully qualified, and I left it.
Okay. So you served your time.
Qualified, yeah.
Qualified, ready for the world. And can you remember the moment when you decided, maybe this isn't for me, I think I'd prefer to go a different route?
Yeah, you know what? I was put in foreman and managerial positions very early on, and we got to run, you know, a security company and stuff at a very young age, you know, and it gave me the, if I can do this, what else could I do? And then, interesting enough, the coaching, although it was volunteering with young people at the time, the coaching says, you know, I could help other maybe young men and women in business. And that's when the seed was, what if I did that? And then I started the coaching, and I started to lean in, get the credentials, qualifications, you know, in leadership, cognitive behavioral, managerial, everything you could learn. I was a sponge. And then I started to work with clients who were in the working world and the business world and so forth. And as I got older, my clients got older. It was just organic. It started to grow, and I started to see, I love this.
And part of it was your part-time work on youth work, because you were doing it.
Triggered it.
And you were able to see, you know, the reward you got from that at the weekend versus maybe what you were getting out of the electrical work.
Do you know what it was? It was a funny one, the way it happened, because I was in my early 20s at this point. The coaching was really taking off, and it wasn't even a thing that was known here. So I had to do a lot of studies, you know, kind of leadership training with John Maxwell in the United States. And, you know, getting his content over here was very hard, but I wanted to kind of learn it. But here's what happened. One of the young men I worked with, who was from the inner city, his mother said to him, if you live beyond 21, please get beyond your 21st birthday, because his eldest brother never did, died of an overdose. Yeah. And that's all his mother had said to him. And he said, that's all she wants from me. And I said, what's your goal? What's your plan? He goes, to survive. And, you know, it was a very tough background. I worked with him, helped him, worked a lot with him. And then we lost touch, and I knew he'd kind of got a job for himself and he was doing well, and he was over 21 at this point. A few years later, I'm walking into the RDS, and walking towards me is this fella, and he's about 6 foot odd. And I said, that's not him, is it? And it was, and he comes over, he goes, Mark Fennell, is that you? And I said, it's me. And I couldn't believe I recognised him, and he recognised me. And he started to get emotional straight away. He says, only for you. He said, I wouldn't be here today. Only for you. And he started just kind of pouring out this emotion. And he says, you were the only person that ever believed in me beside my mother. And because of that, I'm here today. And I said, well, it's not because of it. And I did. I said, you believed in yourself and you put the work in. And
he says, but you helped him get there. You helped him get that self-belief.
And he said, my dream was to move out of the flat. He said, I've done that. I have a house. I have missus and we've a child. And he said, one of my biggest dreams was to buy my mother a dog, because she was never allowed to have a dog in the flats. And he said, and I bought my mother a dog, and he just broke down. And at that moment, for me, I said, I'm going to do this coaching for the rest of the life, because the reward that that gives you is just incredible.
You mentioned accreditation there and, you know, hoovering up information. Because, you know, I suppose life coaching, wellness, a lot of these things aren't very well defined.
No, and they're fluffy, a lot of them.
That's why I ask, is accreditation and qualification in whatever aspects of it, is it important?
It is, because the thing about it was, when I first studied in it, it was called personal and professional development, you know, and that's what you were seen as, that's what you would have. The term life coach came in afterwards. But is qualification relevant? You're helping people and their business and their life, you know. You're dealing with a lot of elements of the pie. You want to have not just the qualifications, but the experience.
Yeah.
Because anyone can get a cert. You know, you can get a cert in 6 months, you know. So you want to get a cert that's replicable, that has some accountability.
But it validates what you do.
Yeah,
even though the experience is probably more important.
Yeah.
Some form of validation.
Yes.
Is probably important for new business particularly.
I would absolutely say that. Like, you know, I got it through the QQI, you know, which is the Irish contingency, and then obviously the International Coaching Federation. So if you're going for someone that calls himself a life coach, I always say, look at their, you know, experience and look at their former clients, and the proof is in the pudding.
Yeah. You got married to the lovely Fiona.
I did.
At what would be described as a fairly young age.
Very young age. Yeah,
we were.
Just turning 22.
And how long were you courting, as the
process? So I know Fiona since I was 7 years old, believe it or not. And she is exceptionally entrepreneurial, and I think there was a pair of us in it, you know, when it comes to business, and we've worked together ever since.
I was given one piece of advice as a young fella, that your life partner is the most important partnership you'll do in any business
100%.
Or life arrangement. Would you subscribe to that?
I would absolutely subscribe to that, because I've seen when it doesn't work and how that goes. So, you know, absolutely, because that's the one thing you want to get right. And, you know, I, as I say, we got together about 18, 19 or something. We got together. She knew me inside out, because she'd literally grown up with me, you know. I wasn't cool enough now till I was about 18. So I might have been chasing her, but she kept running.
Good job. In your early 20s, after you were married, I think anxiety might have come into your world.
You know what? Yes.
And tell me about that, and tell me how you turned that into, you know, maybe, again, a hard school of life, you're anxious, it's causing you difficulties, but you funnel it into something that, you know, helps you help others become less anxious.
You know, I was never someone that would have struggled with anything like that per se, and I was burning out and didn't know I was. And back then it was a time when mental health wasn't a conversation, wasn't even a term that was used, you know. And I was working very hard, because I suppose it was the fruit of success is just working hard, because you love what you do, so you're fully committed, you'll give it 80 hours, you know. And people can't say, how does he work so much? But when it's your own business, you do.
Yeah.
You go all out, and that's what I was doing. We were both, you see, working in the business, so we were both, there was none of us, neither one of us was saying when to stop. So what happened was, then we had started other businesses as well. You know, being a business coach, you can't, it's just osmosis. But long and the short of it, I collapsed one morning in the gym, had a blackout, so to speak, and next thing I was in A&E being treated for a suspected heart attack, and I'm in my early 20s. So it blows you out of the water.
And was that as a result, or was the, did the medical people say to you that it was a result of doing too many things, that you were losing control of your life?
They basically said, looking by your blood markers and your stress, and they said the chest pains you're having is stress, the pins and, you know, all of these sensations, which are anxiety symptoms, which I didn't know, which can be very likened to a heart attack. It wasn't my heart, thank God. But they said that's what it is. But the problem, what happened to me was fear got in. I realized I wasn't bulletproof. I wasn't made of lead. And the fear came in, health anxiety. And for the following year and a half to 2 years, anxiety was an everyday occurrence for me. Someone that never struggled with it now was, you know, the battlefield was my mindset, and it was the worry of, did they get it wrong? Maybe it is my heart. Maybe it was misdiagnosed, et cetera, et cetera. And every sensation or anything like this, I was hypersensitive to it. And so it took me, I didn't go on medication. The doctor was saying, take the medication. And I just didn't. I'm not against it, but I didn't. I said, the coach in me said, if I got myself into this, I'm going to try everything. And if I can't get myself out, then I will reach for external help. Because I wanted to, this is, you see, the problem with me, I wanted to understand it, even though I hated it.
Yeah.
And then when I understood it, I got over anxiety. I've never struggled with anxiety since. And it was the worst thing, but the best thing that ever happened to me, because the resilience it gave me and the understanding of our psychology from the health perspective was something that I suppose I can read. I've read all the psychology books nearly, you know, out there, but it taught me more than any book could ever teach me on how we actually work as humans.
Then your experience with having anxiety, dealing with it, makes you a better coach, because I'm sure
that's what happened.
Many of your clients are anxious.
This is what happened. It gave me this full gamut of color. I could see everything now. It wasn't just business strategy. I was now able to see the person behind the business and know, is the problem the business or is the problem the lifestyle? And then, you know, life and business coach is what I suppose I became, because I was just an executive coach before that. But then I realized that, you know, the person behind the business has to have their life in check, not just the business strategy.
It was one of your challenges in the early years of being a life coach that there's only one you, that there's only one Fiona. In terms of trying to grow a business like that.
Scalability is a problem.
When it's just you, and so much of you is the business.
It is. And this is what happens, because anyone calls, they want to talk to you. You know, they don't want to talk to someone else. You can't put someone in your place. So from a, it's a service industry. So scalability is your biggest challenge, because you can't replicate it, you know, unless you can replicate other coaches. But at the end of the day, you're the brand, you know, the personal brand. That's the challenge. And I suppose at this point in my life now, doing it for over 20 years, you know, I'm like, how could we scale beyond here? You know, and that is probably the objective. Still haven't figured out all the nuts and bolts here yet. But I think in today's society, you know, I have systems that I bring into companies and business owners. People aren't always looking for other systems. They're just looking for that soundboard of a person that has the experience to help them get through what they're getting through. Most business owners know what system, if they sat down for an hour, they could kind of figure it out.
Yeah.
They sometimes just need that other person to acid test it. I think that's the part that's hard to replicate.
Your work with SMEs, and again, having been one, I think I know a lot about how they work and, you know, the problems that are within, not to generalize it, but you talk about the three biggest, I suppose, issues with a CEO of an SME being fear, self-belief, and perfectionism. Let's talk about those for a second.
Yeah.
Fear I get, because it's a seriously lonely place.
Yeah,
I get the fear, I get the responsibility that can come with that fear, where you're thinking about your wife and kids or whatever your arrangement is at home.
The roof over the head.
And letting them down. So fear is a good driver, but it doesn't, it can be an inhibitor as well.
Absolutely. People have come to me and, you know, and they said, I'm just out the door, I'm very busy. And I will ask them, you know, why are you so busy? Oh, there's so much to do and there's a long to-do list. What I want to figure out is the motivation, the why behind what they're doing.
Yeah.
And also, are you doing all this because of fear, or are you doing all this because of passion? And the two greatest forces that drive human beings across the planet, you know, in a general sense, is either love or fear, you know, passion or fear. And a lot of the time, a business owner is being run, kept up at night, because they're it's fear that's driving them. The fear of, what if it doesn't work? What if I can't get enough done? What if I don't do enough and my competitor does more and now I lose? But a lot of the time we'll be trying to rewire that back to what helped them start the business, the passion. That's a more creative space.
To try and channel it, or yeah, channel some of it at least.
It doesn't go away.
To be a driver, yeah.
It's getting it in a lesser volume, that it's not the loudest voice in your head.
Talk to me about self-belief, because that's always, you know, somebody who's successful often wonders why, you know, often they don't know themselves why they are successful. Mm. Some people struggle with imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
Why am I here? I just don't feel I should be here. I'm not good enough.
Yeah.
Doubt. Those doubts and that self-doubt, what are your sort of techniques for maybe overcoming that?
Great question. I mean, the first thing that happens is the reason it exists, the self-doubt, is our brain is a threat detective system. It's always trying to find out what might threaten us, you know, and if it can't see external, it goes internal. Well, maybe I'm not the best at this. Maybe there's better than me. So we self-reflect. It's trying to reassure us. But then by doing the reassurance, we examine ourselves. And through that self-diagnosis, we realize I'm not strong here, I'm not strong there. And then that becomes a reason to self-doubt. So it's understanding that your brain is just doing what it's meant to do. So that's not a problem. Just because you doubt yourself doesn't mean that it's even truth to it, number one. The second thing is, when it comes to self-belief, self-belief and across the board is built more through action than it ever will be by thinking or words.
Right.
Literally making the steps is what builds the confidence. You may feel like you're new at something. You may feel like you're an imposter and so forth. But imposter syndrome, even though it might be there, it might be in your shoulder, don't let it be the driving force and voice. Take that ownership of it. Don't fear it, because everyone is new and faking it till they make it. And I've worked with enough CEOs at this stage that have started businesses from their backyard who literally didn't know what they were doing. Most people don't know fully what they're doing. Most people don't have qualifications in every area that they're working in. But you have to just take the imposter syndrome, accept that it exists, accept that it's there, and let the louder voice be that I can do this, I'm well able to do this, let's get the show on the road.
The third one I wanted to ask you about was perfectionism. Mm. So, you know, is sometimes good is good enough? Is good enough ever okay? Is, you know, the strive for absolute perfection can be the undoing of so many people?
Oh, absolutely. The more perfect you try and be, the slower you'll move.
Yeah.
And that's the problem with perfectionism. So done is better than perfect.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about something for an hour or two or three and nothing's happened is not serving you. So it's getting that balance between, you know, what is your best. It can always be better, and we'll always find reasons to make it better, but it's about making it good enough that it's seen and stands above the parapet compared to your competitors. That's the objective first and foremost. The mistake we make is we try make it perfect based off our own eyes and our own experience. The reality is most people don't see what you're seeing. They don't notice the detail you're picking up on. Is it relevant? Should it be addressed? If you can, great. But if it's going to slow down what you're doing, speed is key. Everything will have flaws, and as long as a human's behind it, there's going to be a flaw in it somewhere. You can't get perfection. You know, it's like what do they call it? Writer syndrome. They keep rewriting the chapter. The book never gets published.
My guest is Mark Fennell. This is Life and Leadership. I'm in a car here in the Phoenix Park. Mark is a high-performance life coach. Mark, another thing I wanted to ask you was, why should somebody have a life coach?
The role of a good coach is to get you to be future focused. You know, where are you at? Where do you want to get to? Why you want to get there? And what's holding you back from getting there? So that's the kind of the general starting point.
So if you talk about therapy, you talk about looking backwards.
That's backwards focused, yeah.
And if you talk about coaching, you're looking forward.
100%.
And does anything in the past matter when you're looking forward?
And it does, and quite often now, this is one of the things that I always say to people, is that sometimes we need to revisit the past so that you can process it or understand it, but don't set up camp there.
Yeah.
You know, you shouldn't be talking about your past with your coach for 6 months. You know, there's a time for it, but then we move. It's like even therapy, they recommend if someone goes to therapy, you shouldn't be with the same therapist for longer than 12 months. You know, you have to change. So it's past is always going to be relevant, because a lot of our kinks in our armor come from that. But it's not a place to set up shop and understand that no past is perfect. I think one of the most dangerous things that people do now is, and I see this with clients I've had, they look back at their younger years with an adult mind and they see the child. And if you're looking at yourself as a child with an adult mind, you'll start to feel a great compassion going, how could someone treat that child like that? How could someone do that? And the problem is that can get you, that sets off a psyche that's not always going to be the best for you. You can see yourself then as starting to see yourself as a victim and so forth. My point is, it's good to look back at the past, but remember, at the time when you went through what you went through or whatever else, you got through it in many ways. You dealt with it then. To revisit it and try and reprocess it and look at it from different angles, it can help, and it does help, but you don't want to set up shop there and keep revisiting it over and over and over again.
And how much of a coach is the role of a sounding board? How much is it of a driver, of somebody to push you, to motivate you, to drive you on? And or does the coach have a role of just being there for the person?
I work predominantly with business owners, and they have people who are there for them. They have people who are just soundboards. I think, you know, a coach needs to be a little bit more than that. I think a coach needs to be, it's not about bringing the solutions. It's about asking the right questions.
Yeah.
Because once the answer comes from within a person, they never forget it because they've kind of figured that themselves. It's about pulling on their strengths and helping them, I suppose, build them up in many ways. So you are, in many ways, starting a momentum, starting a motivation. You're helping them flip their mindset from maybe, you know, if they've been fixed mindset in certain areas to more of a growth mindset. But you're doing it through questionings. You're doing it together. You're leading them, but you're not telling them, if that makes sense.
Selling the business and then getting new clients, getting, I suppose, higher value clients because of the confidentiality piece where you're not going to disclose your coaching relationship with the wider world. Does that inhibit growth?
It does. Absolutely.
I thought it might.
But it would does. I've NDAs up to my chins.
But would I write in saying that even discreetly, there's a third party referral going on. So somebody who you're working with who doesn't want to be identified, rightly so, and your relationship is private, but they might say to somebody they know, you need to talk to this guy.
It does, yes, very much so. I've never run ads for what I do, if you get me. It's always been word of mouth, to be fair. I think because I'm results driven, and any good coach should be the same. You know, if you're going to work with someone for 6 months, they need to see that 6 months has yielded, you know, and that's how it is. And obviously when they do yield, then they meet someone else that might be in a need, they'll talk about you. But what I do find is this, particularly the high performers, the medium kind of enterprise level, you know, the big businesses, they don't want people knowing who's coaching because they don't want their competitor coming along to me going, tell us what you told him.
No, that's valid.
So it stays within their circle.
And then your work on Instagram, your commentary on TV, on radio, that's another way of selling your business, but it protects the anonymity of your clients. So I presume one of the reasons that you do that work is, again, to build your profile.
It's interesting you ask that because it didn't start as that. Yeah. You know, when I went through what I went through with anxiety, I realized there was nothing about that out there. And I started a blog back then. And then someone says, why don't you bring what you write about to social media and helping people with that? So, the anxiety, the bullying, the mindset, the growth. Because I never really talk about the business stuff I do, which is 90% of my income. And on the social media, it's all more life stuff. But where I make an income is working with business people. So it was just, it grew legs and grew and grew and grew. And the whole idea behind that at first was, and still is, was just to give people information that makes sense from experience and that's proven that will help people. Yeah. And it's the stuff that I've had to learn myself or I've seen clients go through. But it has, I suppose it was never the purpose of it, but it now serves part of that purpose. Yes, it does put your name in front of people, and it's good for that now. Yeah. I've seen that in later years.
And then if you go back to the advice that you're given via Instagram, maybe let's look at a few of those. dealing with people who put you down.
Yeah.
And again, I like the way you use the
matchstick draw, man. I know, yeah, well, art wasn't my strong point.
No, but subject. Because it said to me that there's a simplicity in, and sometimes being simple isn't easy.
Yeah.
And I think keeping stuff simple, particularly when you're trying to communicate maybe difficult and challenging things.
Yes.
To do that in a simple way is a real art.
You know, it's one of the things, I suppose, if I have to be able to understand it and convey it, and it has to be simple, because if you put it this way, I remember I was working with an individual, and he was a script writer for Fair City back in a long time ago. And he said to me, you know, if a 12-year-old can't understand this script, it's too complex.
Yeah.
And I've never forgotten that. And I always said, that's the way I need to. So when I do a workshop, I will keep it simple. But I'll make sure people go away with those aha moments because it was simple. Some, you know yourself, the simple messages are sometimes the most profound.
You don't recommend to-do lists. I thought this was interesting.
No.
And again, tell me why. I'm somebody who uses them.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I hear you. I've done away with them, and it's the best thing I've ever done. So Harvard Business School did a study on multimillionaires, and they wanted to find out how they don't get overwhelmed and what is their technique. And one of the common things they discovered was there's no to-do lists. You know, now they all have PAs, I know that, so that, you know, but here's even the PAs. Everything is calendared. So if you get something, anything at all, I want to meet you for a coffee, out with the calendar, right when? Now, if you can't find space, that means there was no intention it's ever going to happen, right? If it's the case, oh, I'll get back to you, that's a really, they're not getting back to you. So you calendar everything. If you've got to do a work at home, if you've got a job, if you've got a meeting, now here's why it works from a psychology perspective. When we know that everything's in a calendar, we know that everything is accounted for. We don't have this 3 o'clock in the morning, wake up, oh, did I do this? Oh, I have to get that done tomorrow. No, it's all sorted. Now for me, I will look at my week ahead Monday morning because I know it's already organized. So it takes away a lot of the stress, a lot of the trying to remember everything in our heads, which we all do.
And what about if you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and something comes into your head?
Write it down.
Yeah, so that is a to-do list of sorts.
It is. It's just not an ongoing one. So that, and I will sometimes, like if I'm in a meeting, you know, in a conference and someone brings something up at a table or whatever, a boardroom, and I'll write down some stuff. I don't have the time to go to my calendar then, but after that meeting or that evening, I will put it in. So that's a short-term to-do list, yes. But that to-do list won't sit there for 3 days or 2 days.
Yeah, it has to.
So you're right. If you wake up at nighttime and you've something in your head, the best way to go back asleep is write it down.
Oh, no, that's right. And as I say, I don't look at a to-do list in that way. It's a list. I will get through all those things that come in that I write down. If it's important enough to write down, it's going to get done.
You've got intentionality to get it done. Most people make, shall I say, a to-do list, but you know, statistically, what, 80% sits there for 6 months later and they're still frustrated. So to avoid the stress, get a decent digital calendar on your phone and start putting it into calendar, and you'll be surprised how much we think we can do that we can't actually get to.
Yeah. Some other things I wanted to ask you about, we mentioned it there, dealing with people that put you down. Again, you've a technique for that, which I'd like you to share with us because I thought it was really powerful.
Yeah, when someone's trying to belittle you or put you down, they're trying to put you less than them because they see you as more than them. And that's their insecurity speaking. If someone says something that's belittling, say, what do you hope to achieve by saying that to me?
Yeah.
And go quiet. You know, silence is your friend. Silence can be more powerful than endless words. Yeah, Just go quiet and ask them, what's your intention? Or did you mean to make that sound as insultive as it could have? You know, was your intention for that to hurt me? Because it could come across that way. Give them the benefit of the doubt. Some people will back off. And if they follow through and say, yeah, that's what I meant. Well, now you know where you stand with that person and the type of person they are.
You say as well that you can't be a villain in a story that you're not part of.
Yeah.
You know, this is where somebody maybe has animosity or, you know, is hostile to you and you don't kind of know why.
Sometimes.
And this happens with a lot of people who are in the public eye, for instance.
Always.
You know, why do all these people hate me?
Yes.
They don't know me.
Because, and this is true, and I've had clients who've been attacked and they've been in the pages of the papers and they've wondered, you know, why do I get so much hate? You know, the thing is, you see, sometimes people will not like you because of something you either stand for or the fact that you stand for something at all, because they wish they could stand for it, but you stand for it. So the point being is, sometimes people will not like you for many reasons. It can be jealousy. It can be they want what you have. You're happy they're not. It can be whatever, your political stance, your religious stance, whatever it might be. They don't like you because of your views. And so what they try and do is they want to basically see you as the enemy because of your views being different. And so I always say to people, you can't be a villain in someone's story, in a story that you've never read. You don't know what they're saying and you don't know why they're saying it. You don't know what's in their heads. So don't bother.
Just ignore it.
you are better off ignoring. And I know a lot of the PR people out there will say, you know, you got to do press releases when it comes to that kind of stuff. There's a time for that, but if you try and put out every fire, you'll become a very busy fireman and not actually doing what you're meant to be doing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The narcissist, you know, someone who focuses solely on themselves, no regard for others. Are there many narcissists out there?
A narcissist believes that everyone else is the problem bar them.
Yeah.
So they don't sign up to, you know, a psychologist to get assessed on by a narcissist, because they say, well, I'm not the problem. They're the narcissist. They'll always turn the tides. So they don't know how many. They say that there's about 2-3% that reported of being narcissistic personality disorder. But then people can be very narcissistic but not have the disorder, you know. So they're on like a spectrum almost. But the reality is they estimate there's about 1 in 5 people are, you know, full-blown narcissists.
20%.
We're kind of based off the victim's reports of it. So it's a very hard number to kind of, you know, pin down, to be fair. Yeah. And I'm always shy to do that with statistics unless it's really proven. But the bottom line is people are quite narcissistic, and we can see it in everyday society. A narcissist is someone that's all about self and about protecting image. And if you help me get where I'm going as a narcissist, they'll support you. If you come against me, get in the way, or I can't control you, you're a problem, you're a potential threat. So therefore, they might use emotional manipulation or other techniques. And it can get quite sinister. Like there's the malignant narcissist, there's sociopaths, which is one step above that. There's different spectrums, and some are more, should we say, sinister than others.
Wow, okay. What drives your Instagram program? What, you know, the little clips you put up, some of them we've just discussed there.
It's clients' stories.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, you know, like it's a lot of it is clients' stories. It might even be sometimes people who message me.
When you're dealing with your SME clients in particularly, you know, everybody has maybe a different view on what success looks like. Do you get people to define success to them and what it looks like for them before? Is that one of the base points that you start?
It is.
Is that where you start saying, like, what does it look like?
So many of us are looking for security, you know, and financial. So once we're financially secure, that's the objective. We want to have the roof over the head, the family, the kid, you know, the security is the driver behind the business. The thing I always ask though, but what's success? So you've got the hundreds of millions in the bank. What's success look like for you? What most people don't realize is we're not all chasing happiness either. Because happiness is an emotion. It can be happy today, but there can be a reason to be unhappy tomorrow. Reality is, true success is contentment and fulfillment. Now, I always ask a client, what makes you content and what makes you fulfilled? That's the direction we need to go. Because when you go that direction, that's true success. And that will ignite the passion in you more than it'll ignite the fear in you. And then you can really drive the business home. Because that's coming from a really good mental headspace.
But does success, when you're in your 20s and the business is small, then versus success when you're in your 60s, maybe trying to hold on to what you have, they're different sort of notches on the bedpost.
Different chapters and different, like there's two clients I have right now. They're both in their mid-50s. They've both been bought out. Great success stories. And they're working on an exit strategy. But now they're in a place of the business was and who I was, and without the business, I don't know who I am, you know, and that's something I'm working on with them. But then you have someone at the beginning of the, you know, is in their early 20s starting on a startup and or whatever it might be, or a tech firm, and success for them is to get to the place of the 55-year-old where I can exit. But it's getting the ducks in a row right early on. And my point being, let's look at the business, but don't work on the business, but don't work in the business. Don't let the business become your identity. That is huge. Like when I wrote my book, Breakthrough, that was so, and people kind of said, what does that mean, Mark, identity and business? When you become your business and it becomes you and that's all you have, take the business away, the person's left wondering who I am. Midlife crisis is when it tends to show up.
But as a society, are we not very much focused on marrying the business person and the individual? So, you know, you go to a dinner party and the first thing someone asks you is, well, what do you do?
Yeah. I mean, schooling in and of itself is a marker of, oh, you got to get a success. You got to get a B, you got to get an A, you've got to succeed in school, to succeed in college, to succeed in career, to succeed at pension. You know, it's all got these goals and that's fine and that's okay. But we've got to make sure that that doesn't become all that we are. So when someone says what you do, great. People always ask me that when I'm at a dinner or whatever. But the point is,
once it's not all you do is the real answer. Because what I learned about burnout the hard way was my business was all I did, you know, and I loved it. So I wasn't looking for something. I wasn't looking for hobbies. But I realized that when you incorporate the additional things like balance and fun and different stuff, you don't need a huge amount of it, but you do need some of it. I worked with a CEO, for example, and he's incredibly busy, incredibly successful. And I introduced him to the gym, and I said, let's just try this. You know, he goes, I'm not a gym bunny. I said, either was I. I said, until, you know, but let me try. So I got him kind of trained and whatever else. Now he wants to leave the business to go play tennis.
Yeah.
Because he said it ignited in him something that he never saw coming. He's playing tennis 3 times a week now. And it wasn't even tennis that I introduced him. It was just, he goes, I love the fact that I'm not thinking of business. I'm enjoying myself. And it's still the competitive side. So he's now, as he'll tell you himself, he's a better CEO since starting to play tennis. Now you make that connection, but there you go.
No, I totally get
amazing.
That. And I also think that maybe you've observed this yourself, but if you're talking to CEOs, is health and fitness, is it a common denominator? Do a lot of them do something that leaves them release energy?
The ones that deal best with stress are all doing some sort of movement in their week.
Yeah.
That's what I've seen. The ones that don't, that are overwhelmed and highly stressed, don't have any. Our nervous system is like a pressure cooker. And if we don't get, like, stress, literally, you know, dis-ease leads to disease. You know, that stress in the body. We got to get that out. You can't deny how we're made biologically and physically. So if you want to be less stressed and be at your best, you do have to clear your head. And exercise, movement, sport, whatever you want to do is the perfect way to do it. And if you want to be a high performer, the people I know who I'd call a high performer, they all have a gym membership.
Yeah.
Just putting that out there.
Yeah. No,
I'm not saying they're the fittest, but they all have some sort of movement. Could be just a treadmill, could be just a spin class, it could be just a Pilates, but they all have something.
So this is Life and Leadership. This is Bobby here. My guest is high performance life coach, Mark Fennell. We're in the car. We've just had to turn on the engine just to get a bit of air in here. And also because the battery was running low. Mark, what age are you now?
I'm coming up on 45.
So 45, a lot of years still to live.
Absolutely.
So where do you see your life? What trajectory are you on?
Coaching is what I do and it's what I love, and it's just so rewarding. The day that it's not is the day I'll stop it, but I don't see it ever stopping anytime soon. But to be honest with you, I've a newfound love. When I say newfound, I've really got to understand and appreciate extreme sports and the area outdoors. And people say these 45 extreme downhill mountain biking I've taken on, it's wild. Don't ask me about it, but I love it. Kayaking and many things like that. I've just found that adding that bit of, you cannot think about anything when you're going down a hill on a mountain bike. And I don't know, there's something about that I love. And you're half afraid as well at the same time.
And does you don't find coaching ever gets repetitive, because there's new energy coming through all the time. There's new people with new problems, with new issues. So it never really stays the same.
A lot of the patterns can be the same, but the circumstances are different. You know, I think as humans, we're not terribly complex, really, when you get under the bonnet. You know, that you can see patterns and similarities. But I think it's the reward, because when you're working with someone and you see them get a breakthrough, or you see them grow a business, like, you know, when you see a person who started a business and they had, you know, 5-6 staff and now they've 800, like, and you've been there for that journey, that just ignites you. Like some of my clients, I'm with them over 12 years.
Yeah.
You know, and it's so it doesn't get old. It is a labor of love. I know it's not for everyone, but I do enjoy it.
When do you know that it's time to move on from a client relationship?
The two answers. The first answer, you never want to become their crutch. You know, they have to, you know, literally, it is a sense of, you want to get them to stand on their own 2 feet. Because sometimes, and I have had clients where they'll do what they do as long as they have me there. But I can't be there indefinitely. So I always try and get them to, you know, push them out of the nest a little bit.
Wean them off.
Because you've been with them from such a, you know, especially if they struggle with imposter syndrome. So there's that side of it. The other side of it is I will always set out a trajectory, you know, and goalposts along the way. And when we've reached those goals, that's when I might either, we might have a break, or we might, you know, reconvene in 6 months, or they can come back at their leisure. So once we've gotten the results they've set out to get, that's when I know my job has been done. The third one is the one that if they're not achieving goals or they're not getting those results, I'll be the first to say, why is that? What needs to change? What's not working? Because that does happen, you know, and you have people who will come to the coach, talk to the coach, but they're not people of action. And you got to wean them out too. Thankfully, they're only probably 1%.
So there are people, and as you say, it's a very low percentage, but there are people who say, oh yeah, I'm going to get a life coach and it's going to sort me out.
Because they think I'm going to fix it for them.
And then they find...
they got to work.
Do you know what? This isn't really what I wanted signed up for.
Yeah, they want you to do the work, you know. Yeah. And sometimes, you see that, sometimes like CEOs who I've worked with will send me their senior managers. And the senior managers just come along to tick the box for the CEO. And those kind of people I don't last long with, because I'm like, you're only doing it for them. You're not actually here to actually get results. So yeah, you've got to just be realistic.
Two other questions maybe for you. The first one is, who is your life and leadership? But maybe answer me first, advice that you give to your 25-year-old self.
Your job is what you do. It's not who you are.
Yeah.
So don't let it become all that you are.
Yeah.
That's probably what I would have said to myself. Yeah. Balance.
Good job. And then is there somebody out there that really influences you?
My grandmother, who's no longer with us, was definitely the person who instilled in us all self-belief, you know, and encouragement. And she had 19 children, 12 survived. She had cancer, I think, 5 times.
Stop.
And she outlived 2 husbands. She went through incredible, and she read her son who was in a wheelchair. That was an incredible woman. And I think
she had a saying, hadn't she?
She did, yes. Yeah, she said, yeah. I'll never forget that. It stuck with me. If I was going to get a tattoo, it would be it. She says, as long as you can be vertical by choice, you have something that people would do anything to have. And I think that is just the essence of the story. Like, if you've more going for you than you think. And if something that's worrying you today, would it matter in 5 years from now? Probably not, you know. And I think that's the key. It's, will this matter in 5 years from now? Most things we worry about today don't.
Well, listen, it's been a real pleasure, Mark. Mark Fennell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
On Life and Leadership. I really enjoyed our conversation.
I absolutely did, and thank you for having me.
Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr.
A News Talk original. Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.